across Iowa, Wisconsin, and far northern Illinois tonight. It will be dry elsewhere. The front will sag slowly southward, bringing a chance of showers and thunderstorms to the entire region tomorrow. Cooler and drier weather is in store for us Saturday. Highs today will range from the low 60s across northern Iowa and southern Wisconsin to the mid-70s across Missouri, southern Illinois, and western Kentucky. Lows overnight will range from the mid-30s across northern Iowa and southern Wisconsin to the mid-50s across southern Missouri, southern Illinois, southern Indiana, and western Kentucky. The forecast for east central Illinois this afternoon, mostly sunny, warm, and breezy with a high of 68 and the wind from the south at 20 to 25 miles per hour with gusts to 35 miles per hour. Tonight, mostly cloudy with a low of 52. The wind will be from the west at 10 to 15 miles per hour with gusts early this evening up to 25 miles per hour. Tomorrow, partly sunny with a chance of showers and thunderstorms and a high of 62, with the temperature holding steady or falling slightly tomorrow afternoon. The wind will be out of the northeast at 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tomorrow night, mostly cloudy and cooler with a low of 35. Saturday, sunny with a high in the mid-50s. Saturday night, mostly cloudy with a chance of showers and thunderstorms and a low in the low 40s. Sunday, mostly cloudy with a chance of showers and thunderstorms and a high in the upper 50s. At noon central time, temperatures across Illinois and Indiana were in the 60s, most stations reporting some sunshine. In Rockford and Chicago at O'Hare Airport, 62 degrees. Bloomington reported 67 degrees. It was 64 at Mattoon, 68 at Carbondale. In South Bend, 63, 66 at Lafayette, 65 at both Indianapolis and Terre Haute. And in Evansville, it was 67. Willard Airport reported partly sunny skies, at the top of the hour. The temperature, 66. The dew point, 52. The wind out of the south at 23 with gusts to 33. The relative humidity, 60%. The barometric pressure, 29.95 and falling. And at 12:39, 65 degrees in Urbana on the campus of the University of Illinois under a partly sunny sky. When the devastating earthquake and tsunami hit Japan last week, Michael Bakaris was on the 19th floor of an office building in Tokyo. The building shook for 11 minutes during the quake. Bakaris grew up in Champaign and studied economics at the University of Illinois. He moved to Japan about 13 years ago for a job in finance and now lives about 200 miles from the earthquake's epicenter. Illinois Public Media's Sean Powers spoke to Bakaris from Tokyo using Skype.
Earthquakes are part of life out here, so most people just kind of pause for a moment, and then as soon as they realize it's nothing too intense, then they just kind of ignore it and go back to whatever they're doing. But in this case, you know, it really was evident quite quickly that this was something different, that this was an intensity that was going to, perhaps not in Tokyo, but wreak tremendous damage somewhere in the country. Even in that building, the swaying and the shaking was so extreme that you couldn't really walk. You couldn't easily stand up. You just had to sit down and hold on to your desk. And if your chair had casters on it, you really had to hold on or you were going to get jerked around a bit. It's a very strange thing to have that experience when you're in a giant square building. It sort of defies your sense of physics because you don't really think that a structure like that can bend and sway and wobble, but it can. It really defies the imagination.
After those 11 minutes of shaking, what was your first action? What was the first thing you did?
The phones were all down, but email was still working. So the first thing I did was sent an email back to my family saying, I'm okay. I had no idea what had happened or where, but I knew that something significant had happened and that probably phone lines were going to be down for quite some time, so I just quickly shot off an email as fast as I could. And then we congregated in the division head's, around the division head's office, because he had a television. He turned it on, and you know, we started to see images of the tsunami overtaking a village in Iwate somewhere. It was just something like I've never seen.
where you are in Japan, is there any indication at this point that the country was hit by a massive earthquake and a tsunami?
What you notice here in Tokyo at the moment is really two things. First of all, because they're trying to conserve energy, the train system has reduced capacity to something like a third of what it normally carries. And it's busy on a good day here in Tokyo. So, you know, getting around on the trains right now is quite difficult. You have to wait a long time for a train to come, and when they do come, you're really, really packed in there, if you can fit in the train at all. Additionally, a lot of the types of foodstuffs that are going to be directed northward for the foreseeable future have sort of vanished in Tokyo. So you can walk into any convenience store, bread store, supermarket, and, you know, a third of the items are just completely gone and probably won't come in for quite a while.
Are you at all concerned about some of the health risks from the affected nuclear reactors in the country?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that. I'm not terribly concerned about it because I understand the science behind it, and the foreign media has made a much bigger deal of this than it actually is. And although it is getting ongoing press coverage here in Japan, it's not the sort of catastrophic, dire, end-of-the-world Holocaust scenario that is being depicted in the American media. For example, CNN and Fox News, and the German media seems to be picking it up in a way that distorts the actual case of this reactor. And it's causing a bit of a panic in the foreign community, which is really unjustified. I guess I'd like to make an appeal to anybody that's listening to participate, if they can, in the relief effort in some way. You know, make a donation to your favorite relief organization or see if there's some way you can get involved. I personally, for my bit, I'm thinking seriously about quitting my job and moving up north for a couple of years to see if I can help with the relief effort. That's only one person's effort, but I think every little bit counts.
Former Champaign resident and current Tokyo resident Michael Bakaris speaking with Illinois Public Media's Sean Powers. California Pacific Gas and Electric Company plans to test and possibly replace hundreds of miles of aging gas pipelines in the wake of last year's explosion in San Bruno, California. The explosion killed 8 people and destroyed 38 homes. Regulators, meanwhile, say the company must hand over all pipeline records or face fines of $1 million a day. NPR's Richard Gonzalez has more.
After the San Bruno explosion and fire, the California Public Utilities Commission ordered the company to turn over pipeline pressure test records for all the transmission lines running through populated areas. PG&E turned over some records, but said it couldn't find others. That's not acceptable, says Commission Executive Director Paul Clannon.
They need to get the message strongly that business as usual doesn't cut it for natural gas pipeline safety, and they need to get us the records that we need to set those pressures safely.
Before the explosion, the utility thought the ruptured line, built in 1956, was seamless. A federal investigation has shown that it was welded together and that those welds were substandard. Earlier this week, PG&E said it would test and perhaps replace more than 150 miles of transmission lines with high-pressure water, a process called hydrostatic testing. Until now, the company had resisted calls for such measures, citing cost and inconvenience. A spokesman says it will continue its search for records. Richard Gonzalez, NPR News, San Francisco.
For the time being, there will be no executions in Georgia. The Drug Enforcement Administration has seized the state's supply of sodium thiopental, one of 3 drugs used in lethal injection. The government has questions about whether the drug was imported illegally from Britain. Several other states may also have to answer questions about how they obtained their supplies. NPR's Kathy Lohr reports.
There's been a lot of secrecy surrounding how states have been getting sodium thiopental since a U.S. company stopped making the sedative in 2009. Records show Georgia bought the drug from the English distributor Dream Pharma. In court, the Georgia Department of Corrections said it was not worried about the quality of its supply, but defense attorneys got records that showed the state may have violated federal law in obtaining the drug.
Georgia has engaged in a pattern of illegality and shady misconduct to get drugs to execute people.
William Montross is an attorney with the Southern Center for Human Rights in Atlanta. He says the state bought sodium thiopental from a secondary distributor, a company that operated out of the back of a London driving school. Montross says many defense attorneys condemned the practice and questioned the quality of the drugs.
This stuff was going on for months and months beforehand, and it was in court, and federal and state judges had an opportunity to do something, and no one did anything. They just turned a blind eye. And then finally, DEA steps in.
Since the shortage of sodium thiopental began, some suggested the Food and Drug Administration should inspect the quality of the drugs being imported, but that agency declined to get involved. The DEA has not said whether it will seize supplies of sodium thiopental in other states, but some following the issue say the agency should. Deborah Denno is a professor at Fordham Law School.
You know, we've already seen that the shortage has delayed executions in a number of states, you know, Arizona, Arkansas, California, Georgia, and Tennessee, and all those states have had to go to England for their supply of the drugs. So it bears investigating whether those states have been engaging in the same kind of activity as Georgia has been.
A DEA spokesman in Atlanta says the agency is working with the Georgia Department of Corrections to make sure it complies with federal regulations, but declined further comment. The Georgia Department of Corrections did not return calls. But defense attorneys cite another problem. They say Georgia officials sold some of their supply of sodium thiopental to Kentucky officials. That raises more questions about where the drugs might end up.
Once the drug enters the country, there's a real risk of diversion.
Megan McCracken is with the Death Penalty Clinic at the University of California, Berkeley.
There's no guarantee that the drug will remain within this closed system of capital punishment. In the past month, we've learned that the state of Kentucky purchased sodium thiopental from a private company in Georgia. And so if a private company is selling it, we now have sort of realization of this risk of the drug entering the stream of commerce.
An open records request in Kentucky revealed that state had purchased sodium thiopental from Correct Health, a Georgia company that provides all medical services for the Georgia Department of Corrections. The head of that company denied selling the drug. As questions remain over the supply of sodium thiopental, states are seeking alternatives. Texas officials just announced they will join two other states, Ohio and Oklahoma, and switch to using the sedative pentobarbital. Texas plans to use the new drug in an execution scheduled for next month. Kathy Lohr, NPR News, Atlanta.
Congress votes Thursday on a new bill affecting public broadcasting. H.R. 1076 would prohibit public stations, including WILL, from using federal funding to purchase or broadcast radio programs from any source. This bill would impact our national and international news service, including Morning Edition, All Things Considered, The World, and the BBC. Let your representatives know your opinion. Contact information is at will.illinois.edu.